Hello and welcome to Business Daily from the BBC World Service, the business podcast which brings you the trends, the money and the people who make the world and its money go round. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
Hello there, I'm Ed Butler and welcome to Business Daily from the BBC. Today, a question that's dogged the Trump administration from the very start. Is the president using his business to profit from running the country?
Donald Trump successfully ran on a ticket of draining the swamp, of being different. I think the saddest thing about the outcome following the election is that he's proven to be exactly the opposite.
Yes, court cases are being brought over the perceived conflicts between Donald Trump's business and his presidency. But is this just a symptom of an age-old corruption within US politics? That's coming up in Business Daily from the BBC. Donald Trump may be the richest, most successful businessman ever to claim the keys of the White House, but his business interests have certainly provided potent ammunition for some critics who say he's using the presidency for personal gain. On what basis, though, can they say that? That's our theme today. Well, here are some examples. There was that time, for instance, when he invited the Japanese Prime Minister to his personal golf course and private members club to discuss, well, his personal golf course and private members club.
Many of the world's great leaders request to come to Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach. They like it. I like it. We're comfortable. We have great relationships. As you remember, we were here and President Xi of China was here. And now it is indeed the Southern White House.
President Trump and the Japanese Prime Minister. Of course, Donald isn't the only Trump family member with a potential conflict of interest.
Ivanka Trump once again faces questions about whether she is personally profiting from her White House role. The Associated Press reports the Chinese government granted her company three new trademarks on April 6th. Hours later, she dined with the Chinese president at her father's...
That's Ivanka and her global fashion brand. Then there's Don Jr. and his recent business trip promoting the Trump business brand in India.
They're not selling access directly, but... it raises a question if the president's name is on this property, if his son is hawking these properties and then giving a foreign policy address, it sort of commingles business and at the same time politics.
The comments there of critic Sumit Ganguly on Don Jr.'s planned, and it should be said, abandoned foreign policy address that he was planning to make during a recent trip to India. So what do we know about all of the mingling of business and politics within this particular presidency? At the start of it, Mr. Trump did promise to stand back from his businesses, passing control to his two adult sons. But according to Lisa Gilbert, vice president of legislative affairs at Public Citizen, a non-profit watchdog in Washington, D.C., it's hardly separated the man from the brand.
He did promise to isolate himself from management by giving his companies to Don Jr. That said, there are no real safeguards in place to keep his son from talking to him directly about the business. And then the money itself is in a trust that Donald Trump still has access to. So any distinction between Trump Enterprise, Trump Org, and himself is artificial.
How is he profiting? I mean, what is the direct evidence that
he is profiting on a week-by-week basis.
So his enterprise is entangled, so we don't know all the details, but because it's made up of hotels and golf courses and resorts, many of which bear his name, or if they don't, people know he's connected to them. You know, there are numerous ways where we know that foreign governments or corporations are engaging with his businesses. Public Citizen did an assessment back in January, and we found that there are 64 discrete instances just from what is publicly available that we could find where trade associations, corporations, et cetera, spent money at his properties.
And, of course, Republicans who are perhaps keen to be seen to be doing the right thing by their president.
Indeed. Whether it's holding your fundraiser at the Trump Hotel or talking a bit about Mar-a-Lago while you're on TV, there are lots of ways to curry favor with the president through engagement with his empire.
Mar-a-Lago, you mentioned that. That is, of course, as he himself has described it, the Winter White House.
Yes, it is unprecedented the amount of time the president spends at some place that is not Camp David or the White House. Mar-a-Lago is certainly seen and is a place to gain access to Donald Trump, a place where if you stay there and spend money there, he will know about it. As people stay there, Mar-a-Lago has begun charging more and more because people know there's another reason to stay there besides the palm trees. And as that's been happening, that money goes into his pockets, if not immediately, eventually when he sees it again.
Tell me about the evidence for which you might argue foreign governments are themselves offering concessions to the Trump Organization, to Donald Trump, or indeed to Ivanka Trump, his daughter, in order to curry favor, in order to promote shifts in U.S. policy.
So this is a space where Donald Trump is potentially actually in violation of law. There is a clause of the Constitution, the Emoluments Clause, it's newly famous, which says that the president should not be taking anything that could be constituted as a bribe from foreign nations. So there are several court cases currently suing on this topic, and we'll see resolution of it hopefully within the next couple months.
If he is breaking the law, surely he's going to get prosecuted, or his organization will. There's going to be a price for that, and yet he hasn't been, not successfully. So maybe we're overstating his wrongdoing here.
Well, I think it's a court case, so it's an open question, but we don't think so. I think there's pretty clear lines between money that is going into properties that he will eventually get from foreign nations and what the Emoluments Clause is in place to prevent. So, you know, we believe that we will see these cases resolved in a favorable manner. That said, there is no question that Donald Trump thinks he is above the law.
Donald Trump, of course, won the White House. To a large degree, because Americans agreed with the premise that a businessman, a rich, very successful businessman, was going to be a very good, effective president.
That's true. I think people are tired of business as usual. And Donald Trump successfully ran on a ticket of draining the swamp, of being different. I think the saddest thing about the outcome following the election is that he's proven to be exactly the opposite, exactly the swamp monster that he said he was fighting against, whether it's filling his cabinet with the most conflicted set of players from Pruitt to Ross that we've ever seen, who are clearly using their offices to enrich themselves, to what he is choosing to do himself as he seeks to personally profit off of policy choices. There is no doubt in my mind, and I think as Americans watch what's happening, more and more so in everyone's, that he has not been a changed president.
So you can't be a successful businessman and a president?
You can, but you should turn your business acumen to helping people rather than yourself.
Lisa Gilbert of Public Citizen. So what's the administration's response to all these allegations? Well, actually, not very much. Not in detail, anyway. Take the recent lawsuits announced over the alleged misuse of Trump Foundation money, or the claims that Mr. Trump withdrew sanctions against a Chinese tech firm just days after his daughter received a series of trademark approvals from Beijing. In both cases, the only response from the White House has been that the allegations are baseless. They come from biased political enemies. What about that wider question, though, I just raised with Lisa Gilbert? What is the historical record of businessmen presidents? A man who studied the question is the veteran forecaster and director of the University of Virginia Center for Politics, Larry Sabato.
It's important to stress that we've only had 44 people serve as president. And when you have a number of cases this small, I think you have to be careful not to overread whatever the data may show. But as far as American presidents go, by and large, the business people elected president have not been terribly successful, with one exception, and that, of course, is Harry Truman. And ironically, he was a failed businessman. He was a failed haberdasher. The very successful businessmen, which included Herbert Hoover, for example, did pretty miserably in the Oval Office.
Herbert Hoover, the man who gave us the Great Depression, some would say.
Well, he certainly made it worse. And he didn't believe that government should undertake any real action to affect the economy. Terrible mistake that cost him a second term.
As you say, the truth is no president has really ever had the profile that Donald Trump has. None have had anything like his huge business experience, or, of course, for that matter, his entire lack of political experience.
Precisely right. Hoover, for example, was Secretary of Commerce for his predecessor. So that gave him some governmental experience. Trump had done none of this, and it shows. The Speaker of the House, who's a Republican, Paul Ryan, told us publicly he had to school Donald Trump on separation of powers, on our constitutional provision dividing the federal powers into three, executive, legislative, and judicial.
Speaking of constitutional provisions, the emoluments clause is one of those, isn't it? And we have in this program been discussing the president's potential conflicts of interest. Cases now are being brought, aren't they? Constitutional lawyers, of course, are wringing their hands. But the truth is, surely, amidst all of the noise that we're having every day about trade wars, North Korea, Iran, you know, children being separated from their parents at the border, it is pretty hard to get American voters, much less Congress, exercised about this subject.
Yes, it is so far, because Trump does generate not just a lot of news, but also a lot of controversies. I don't think even 20% of Americans know what the emoluments clause is. That's part of the problem. The other part is it's tough to prove that foreign governments have used monies to influence the president of the United States unless you have a videotape of a president taking a bribe. What many of the critics are suggesting is that foreign leaders, when they come to Washington, D.C., make a beeline for the Trump Hotel. All the profits go to the Trump family. They stay, and all their delegations stay in the Trump Hotel. It's now apparently one of the most successful hotels in Washington. It makes a great deal of money. And then when they go over to the White House or the State Department or wherever they're visiting, they make sure they mention that they're staying in the Trump Hotel. In a sense, that probably buys at least some goodwill from Trump, if not more than that. But it's indirect. Let's say eventually a senior court rules that, in fact, it does apply to the monies that Trump and his family have been getting. Suddenly, it's a major issue. But it's indirect. Now, I'll tell you how emoluments will become important. It's if the other branches get involved. Should Trump ever be put before the House on an impeachment matter, I'll be surprised if we don't have an article of impeachment about emoluments. And then the whole Congress would be judging whether or not there's something there. Also, the courts may have a role in this, since, as you mentioned, there are court cases involving the emoluments clause. Let's say eventually a senior court, appellate or Supreme Court, rules that, in fact, it does apply to the monies that Trump and his family have been getting. Suddenly, it's a major issue. And again, it would go to Congress for consideration of impeachment.
I've read that there is an argument by some Democrats that if and when they do gain control of Congress, they would bring in a new set of rules for future presidents to prevent this type of possibility even arising in the future.
They would have to take control of both houses and the presidency before that could happen. If they just have the House of Representatives, the House could pass a sense of the House resolution, but it wouldn't be binding.
Professor Larry Sabato, you're listening to Business Daily from the BBC with Ed Butler. So let's take a pause from all of this constitutional debate and Donald Trump's own personal record. Is there a broader system within the US political system that supports corruption, rent-seeking? Some certainly think so, to a dangerous degree. Martin Gillen is a professor of politics at Princeton University. He spent years studying what he says is an unusual mismatch for a democracy, the clear discrepancy between what ordinary American voters want to see and what lawmakers in Washington actually enact.
What I looked at was the relationship between what Americans say they want their government to do and what their government does. And I focused on different groups of Americans, and particularly those with low or middle or high incomes, to see whether the policies that they preferred were reflected in the policies that were adopted over about a 25-year period.
And what did you find?
Well, what I found was that there is a relationship between government policy and public preferences, but only among the well-to-do. So once you take into account what affluent Americans want, the preferences of the middle class or the poor have no influence over the policies that the government adopts.
So the conclusion of this is that it is wealth, not electoral power, in other words, the number of votes, that determine much of political policy making.
That is very well put. It's exactly right.
How do you account for that? Because Americans do vote in elections. They vote in quite a lot of elections every couple of years, and people are getting voted and voted out of office according to their record.
Well, to a degree, that is true. People do have choices when they go to the polls, but the only choices they have are those on the ballot in front of them. And in order to run a viable campaign for a national office in the United States, one needs an enormous sum of money. And the only ways to get that money are either to be independently wealthy yourself or to have the backing of wealthy donors.
Do voters simply not notice then that their wishes are being ignored?
Well, I think to a degree they do notice. You know, on surveys, it's very clear that Americans believe the government pays little attention to their needs or their preferences. Surveys ask questions like, do government care about what people like you think? And in the 1960s, overwhelming majorities of Americans felt that their government did care about their needs and their preferences. And that's declined over time, so that now only small minorities of Americans agree with that. So people do notice, but again, their choices are limited to those on the ballot. And in order to get on the ballot, takes the backing of a lot of money.
The way that your research has been sold to me, at least, has been in the context of an oligarchy, describing the United States as an oligarchy. Is that too strong a term?
Well, the term oligarchy conjures up the image of a small number of very affluent people who are calling all the shots. And I think it's more complicated than that. It's shifting sets of coalitions among the well-to-do and among interest groups. So I call it a sort of poorly functioning and very unequal democracy.
At what point do we start seriously seeing this being corrected? Because it does seem to me as though inevitably, eventually, in a free society, it's going to be drawn to people's attention.
You know, this isn't the first time in American history where we've faced these kinds of inequalities and lack of responsiveness from government. In many ways, our current situation resembles the situation at the end of the 19th and early beginning of the 20th century, when government was widely perceived as being corrupt and Congress in the pocket of business interests. And it took decades of pushback, organizing by people like the populists and the progressives to make changes. But changes were made. And perhaps as things continue to go in the direction they have been recently, we will see continued organizing, continued resistance, not just against Trump, but against the kinds of inequalities that our government has been perpetuating.
Professor Martin Gillen, who does point out that in certain ways, Donald Trump could be said to be working against the interests of big money in at least his move to levy tariffs and risk trade war with other countries. So it's a complicated picture. But is there a structural way, I wonder, to eliminate the risk of corruption in any government? That is a tough challenge. Business Daily from me, Ed Butler. Have a great weekend.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We meet people with smart ideas to discover how they might change the world for the better.
And this is a fairly cheap and easy way to get lots more solar capacity into the middle of cities.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.